Even here to defend himself.
Yeah, you would say that he's out to steal the birthright of his older brother.
Oh dear, thank you. Thanks. Tēnā koutou. Hello everybody. What a beautiful day we have today. Made me full of energy. There's a karakia that I really love, a te reo karakia, which we are familiar with, many of us, which starts off tuia ki runga, tuia ki raro, tuia ki roto, tuia ki waho, which reminds us that all our, so many things are bound together, sewn together. Oh, he's arrived. Hi, Jacob, welcome. So the things that are above, the things that are below, the things that are within us, the things that are without us, are sewn together. Think of perhaps a bone needle with strong flax harakeke thread, sewing us all together. And I think that's very much a part of what we believe as Christians as well, that we are part of a big system, and how we are and how we behave affects all those relationships. So tagged on at the end of these fruit of the Spirit is self-control, and I'm really glad it was added in. I don't think it was an afterthought. I think it belongs very much in the list. And I'm really glad that Andrew asked me to help with this series, because I'm not an expert at self-control. Like many of us, we have our areas where we're pretty okay, and then there are the other areas, and then there are the areas we're just not even aware of. So this process has helped me to have a bit of a think about this. So that's really, I'm grateful for that. So thanks for having me. I have instructions from Lynn not to talk too long. So sometimes we are controlled by ourselves, and sometimes we are controlled by others. I brought my watch. So I think self-control is quite a complex virtue, and it's not always easy to understand. And I also think that it's currently suffering from a bit of an identity crisis, which might actually confuse us a bit. I've got a couple of ideas why this would be, and I've also got a couple of ways how we can recognize self-control in its best form by using two challenging examples, and then a few more ideas to help us value and practice self-control, because I do think it's important. So I thought I'd start with a brainstorm. This brainstorm... I'm in control of the controls. So I just press that, do I? How do I press it? How do I do it? Oh, do I turn it on? Yes. Yes, great. And then, okay. There we go, that's fun. How do we recognize it and value it? So I thought we could start off with a brainstorm. So those are some of the words that came to me. I'm sure you've got some others. Some of them look quite good and helpful and useful, like being calm and law-abiding, moderate, maybe having some long-term goals, devoted. We saw the marshmallow thing, that's called delayed gratification, kindness. And then we move a bit to the right, stiff upper lip, uptight, unspontaneous, risk averse, restraint, inhibited, workaholic, all those things that could be signs of actually amazing self-control. Can you see anything that you are in there that you're good at? Things like commitment, determination, patient. Those are all good sides of self-control. A self-controlled person could be seen as staunch, thrifty, sober, polite, and a kind achiever. That's all pretty good. or a repressed, stingy, buttoned-up, self-righteous killjoy. And we know that most of us, many, many of us, and certainly our national character is to value sporting greats who show tremendous discipline, stickability at training and performing to hugely impressive standards. But there may be some in our world who are less keen on those who faithfully honor the sacredness of marriage, who are moderate in their appetites, or who choose to tenaciously care for someone or something vulnerable. So why did Paul include self-control as a fruit of the Spirit? Maybe we could help with answering this question by looking at some words that remind us what happens when self-control is absent. And again, these are just some of my ideas. If you want to add anything, please do. So there's some big words in there, but there are also some smaller ones. So maybe something like loudness. Somebody's not controlled with how they speak and their volume. You know, we're aware of that. We can see the damage there, broken relationships, power and control, blowing the budget. All that kind of stuff. But we also can see in there fun and parties and spontaneity. Perhaps some people who are not very self-controlled are very generous and kind. But we can also see that when people aren't self-controlled, then a lot of hurt and harm can occur. I must say the wind has been a good illustration for me this week. I've got really grumpy with that wind. I don't know about your gardens, but my lovely, fresh spring garden is just damaged. And I don't know if it's going to recover. So I'm grumpy. I think the wind could have been much more sort of, you know, gentle about blowing so hard. And so surely some self-control is essential if we are in any way concerned about others, about God, and in fact about our true selves, while also acknowledging that sometimes being spontaneous, having joy and fun, and perhaps also understanding the problem of self-control that many of us might face, lies in this domain of perhaps experiencing that spontaneity and that joy and also that struggle that we have with self-control. It might be helpful that we struggle with it. We can help others as well. So hopefully those words have, you know, shown us a bit of a range in there. Does anyone want to add anything in there to something that comes for you? The marshmallow example was quite helpful too. I've been wondering why I feel a bit confused about this this value. So I've listed a few things that I think kind of lead us astray a bit on this. So advertising, of course, we can often blame advertising for things. Tells us so often that we deserve a treat and a break and something bigger and better, something other. We've earned the right to relax. We've earned the right to take a break, to let go the reins, to break the rules, and to let our hair down, especially if we use a certain shampoo, to indulge ourselves, to focus on our own wants and desires, purchases, security, comfort, and well-being. And we're hearing all about that so much in COVID times. And so in the hands of these clever advertisers, sometimes self-control comes across as a bit stuffy and uncool and clearly something to be tossed aside in order to consume stuff and focus on ourselves first and foremost. And there is some truth in that and there's some deception. Also, the fact that most of the TV series or movies we read or books movies we watch, books we read, or even media reports have at the center of those a story of one or more people who lost control of themselves. And so someone gets murdered or maimed, or something gets stolen or destroyed. Marriages and other important relationships are undermined. People abuse and violate each other. And wars are fought, or they violate themselves. And so I think we've grown used to this kind of ethos of, oh yeah, we're turning on the movie and there's going to be total lack of self-control. And that's okay, that's entertaining. So we've just become quite friendly with, or comfortable with, a sense that, murder and adultery, they make quite good stories. They're much more interesting than purity and self-control. So that's, I think, a challenging thought for me. To add to this, I also think that through the centuries, the church has become famous for our positions on abstinence from alcohol, smoking, types of clothing, spending, socializing, various political stances, dancing, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, not to mention fun on Sundays. So we've seemed to understand self-control as removing or withholding ourselves from certain activities, cutting things out, and then perhaps being resoundingly judgmental of other people's habits. And so, and also another aspect of this is that some Christians have emphasized an outer show of self-control, while in our hidden and private lives, just desperate, horrific lack of self-control, which totally destroys the lives of others as well as our own lives. So that's a bit of a sobering thought that I've been sitting with. That maybe we just understand self-control really as reining in and not actually being joyous necessarily. Now, Jesus was not like this. We know that. And I wonder if we've forgotten how to recognize self-control, or maybe we're undervaluing what it truly is. Maybe we've become comfortable living with less self-control than is healthy and holy. And so, in a sense, that's a waste of a fruit that we are promised that we can have when we live with the Spirit as part of our lives. I found a clip which I thought illustrated what happens when we don't use and enjoy the fruit that the Spirit gives us. So, Tim, if we could put that one up. That's better. Phew. I've asked Brian to come and read a passage from Matthew 27 just to help us look at self-control as it probably should be.
So it's Matthew 27 from verse 32. 32. Sorry, 32. As they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. And over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you, the Son of God, come down from the if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he desires him." And he said, "I am the Son of God." And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way.
Thanks, Brian. I don't know about you, but whenever I hear those words or read them, I become so edgy and so angry. I'm angry about the unrestrained way in which these leaders gave in to so many weaknesses. They seem at once so petty in their taunts and yet so powerful to wreck a human life and destroy a life-giving philosophy, faith, and practice. They're looking for traps and loopholes and ways to feed their own egos, desire for power, and sense of self-righteousness. And they seem so blind to the truth. We are lucky because we have hindsight. Many centuries have passed, and we know how the story pans out. But right in that minute, they were so in control of another person's life, as well as all the followers of Jesus, really. And they were so out of control of themselves. And Jesus does and says nothing. And I want to shout, "Come on, Jesus, get those hordes of angels to help you. Call on the powerful elements of nature. We know you have control over those. And just give these fools a big shaking up. You know you can do it. You just need to say the word and everything will change. Come on, Jesus," we want to say. And Jesus says and does nothing. How come? How come he has such amazing self-control in this horrific situation? I would like to suggest that we are witnessing self-control at its best, and perhaps if you're like me, you feel like a failure in the face of this. Actually, I'm not sure if I could do this. At its core, there is a certain focus. Jesus is controlling himself not only from something. He's not just controlling himself from jumping off or showing how mighty God is to save. But he's controlling himself for something. Because Jesus knew the deep and unending love of God and the beauty of God's kingdom, he chose not to save himself from the taunts of, and the cross, but rather to save himself for the sake of God's truth, glory, and the future of his disciples throughout all the world for all time to come. So that includes us. He was saving, he was controlling himself for us. Because he had this eternal perspective, he could control his impulses and responses in the present. And to his persecutors, he showed kindness, patience, love, goodness, and a stubborn insistence on not fighting back. He was supremely self-controlled, and we have benefited from this. If I am regularly able to shift my own perspective to one that reflects God's faithfulness and love and God's kingdom values, will I not then be able to use the thoughts, words, and actions that help me and others to grow in the right direction? So that's the challenging place that I've come to through that passage. But I've also been thinking a bit about Parihaka, because on the 5th of November, that's Parihaka Day. My understanding is that it was 140 years ago. In your letter, you had 1879. My understanding is 1881. But anyway, about 140 years ago, that's the day when Te Whiti o Rongomai and Tohu Kakahi, who were two prophets and leaders at the Parihaka Marae, who had, in fact, been warriors in their lives. They were probably very skilled at many of the aspects of warfare and protecting their iwi. They encouraged the inhabitants of the marae to reply to the brutality of their enemy with peace or pakanga, which is non-aggressive struggle. So I've got a few words to read from this book, Ask That Mountain, which is not a great read. It's a horrible read. But it does. It is worth having a look at. And, with all respect, I'm an outsider to all this, although my own country has its own history of brutality. But it is really worth gaining some understanding around the events here. And so on that day, 1st of November, so just before the day, Te Whiti called a meeting in Tohu where they were going to lay down the tactics to be employed before the advancing army. And Te Whiti opened the meeting. The ark by which we are to be saved today is stout-heartedness, and flight is death. Let this sink into the ears of all, even the children. There is nothing about fighting today, but the glorification of God and peace on the land. Many generations wished to see this day, but we, a blind, small, and a despised people, have been chosen and glorified this day. The canoe by which we are to be saved is forbearance. It has been prepared by Tohu during months and years and is now launched, and will bear us safely through the tempests. It will save us all. And he said, let us wait for the end. There is nothing else for us. Let us abide calmly upon the land. The south wind was bringing soldiers and cannon, but none of his people would be food for guns or swords, said Tohu. They would resist without weapons in their hands. And then it carries on. I have no place to hide you except in this marae. We cannot be overcome if united. Those who flee from the guns will fall by them. If you are overwhelmed in this day, be patient. And if you have faith and say, go back, they will go. Te Whiti then rose and gave the final word. If any man thinks of his gun or his horse and goes to fetch it, he will die by it. Place your trust in forbearance and peace. Let the booted feet come when they like. The land shall remain firm forever. So that's another point of tremendous self-control. I believe that Te Whiti said, I can't hold you here. If you want to go and fight, you go. These will be the consequences. And he had explained a way that was very attractive to the people at the marae. But we know, I just need to find myself, in Jesus' case and in Parihaka's refusal to retaliate led actually to great and prolonged and unjust suffering. The sad legacy of Parihaka continues today, But I think we also need to ask what would have happened on both these occasions if Jesus and the people of Parihaka hadn't been self-controlled. Difficult as the outcomes were, Jesus was crucified, the marae was sacked, people were killed and brutalized. These were the results of wise actions with a very long, long, long-term perspective. And so I'd like to emphasize the importance of perspective. The fruit of self-control reflects a certain perspective, one that positions us as a part of a grand scheme on a grand scale, involving large entities like the universe and eternity. Our perspective in turn influences our priorities. Enabling us to set some things aside in order to focus on others. In my view of myself, my neighbor, the world, and if my view of myself and my neighbor, the world, and God expands a little bit in space and time, if I try to see a bigger picture, something much larger and taking place over much more time, perhaps I will understand more clearly the point of caring for my relationships with myself, God, others, and creation. Perhaps I will be more able to face a little bit of pain now, like no marshmallow, for the sake of great gains later. Maybe for me, but also maybe for future generations. Maybe on earth, maybe in heaven. And so I've got a few questions to ask us as I, and a promise to read as I finish. If I am not in control of myself, who or what is in control of me? Have I allowed other factors to control me, like advertising, consumerism, greed, ambition, money, egotism, or even apathy or fear? If I am controlled by fear, then what are these fears? Fear of outcomes, fear of pain, fear of trying new things, fear of failure, being more vulnerable, fear of what others might think or do. So am I not enjoying my piece of watermelon because of fear or other factors? And is any of this okay? Those are big questions. We won't really be able to answer them now, but just a challenge around areas of my own self-control. You know, why? My why, really? Why is it important to be self-controlled in this situation? Am I hurting someone? Am I hurting a relationship with myself, with another, with God, with the earth? Is it important for me to set long-term goals? And also the sense that maybe someone else is controlling my life. Power and control are very solid characteristics of certain people in our world. Am I sure that I am not controlled by somebody else who is wanting to harm me and hurt me? I found a promise in Psalm 32. So it's an ancient promise. It's been around a bit. God has been communicating with us through this promise for a long, long time. Did I put it up? Yes. From Psalm 32. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you and watch over you. Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by bit and bridle, or they will not come to you. Many are the woes of the wicked, but the Lord's unfailing love surrounds the man who trusts in him, and the woman, I would add. So this psalm tells us that trust in our loving God is at the heart of self-control. We need not be led astray. We need not fear or sell our souls. We need not retaliate. We need not fill a deep, empty hole within us with short-lived substitutes. And God promises to guide and teach us and not to control us. So we don't even need to be apathetic and say, God will do it. I don't need to do anything. It sounds to me that God wants to partner with us. We can rely on the fact that God's deep healing and everlasting love is with us every single day and every single night. And this knowledge will help us to bear this vital fruit of the Spirit, to practice it with habit, to enjoy it. And it's a sign of who we are because of who God is and because of what God has done for all of us. Let's just pray. Lord, help me to see you more clearly, to love you more dearly, and to follow you more nearly, day by day. Amen.